It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferris. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, a Wisconsin lab was awarded more than $22 million in grant money by the CDC to test and study the novel coronavirus. The project's research director joins us to let us know what they're working on. First, the federal government considers a family of four bringing in about $26,000 a year or less as living in poverty. For individuals, that number is less than $13,000 a year. Poverty guidelines were established during the country's first attempt to address the issue of poverty more than 50 years ago. Since then, the numbers have held steady with the rate of inflation. Now, a national organization argues that these guidelines are outdated and that they underrepresent the number of people struggling financially in the United States, and that this could lead to problems, especially during the COVID-related economic downturn. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about how poverty is measured? What would you like to see change? Has COVID-19 made your financial situation more precarious? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Shelly Gupta-Barnes is the policy director for the Kairos Center and the Poor People's Campaign. Shelly, thanks for joining us today.
Hi, thank you for having me on.
Well, can you tell us the current federal guidelines for what constitutes poverty? What do they measure? How are they set?
Well, the official poverty line is set by a household food budget that was established in the 1950s. So it's more than 50 years ago. It's almost closer to 65 years ago. And that was based on, you know, a calculation of how much a typical household or poor household would spend on food. And the economy has changed since then. Household budgets have changed since then. How much things cost have changed. And yet the poverty line is still based on that data and that calculation from decades ago. And there are, you know, the federal government has recognized this limitation in this measurement, and a few years ago started putting out what's called a supplemental poverty measure, which looks at a broader range of both household income and expenses. So it does look at, you know, what your geographic, it has different calculations for your geography, you know, some different cost of living, and takes into account certain credits that households also receive. But even that doesn't take into account the expenses for health care or even the debt burdens that many households face today. And so, you know, by underrepresenting, by having a threshold on the one hand that's so low that it's not really counting the broader economic precarity that millions of people are facing, we risk our federal programs not having enough resources, not being allocated enough resources to be able to meet the needs at hand. And so this is something that the Poor People's Campaign has been paying attention to and really pushing to change along with other organizations in the country, especially as the current administration is trying to lower the definition and poverty measure even below what it currently is.
You mentioned health care. What are some of the expenses that loom larger in a family budget in 2020 than they did 60, 65 years ago?
So the cost of education, the cost of transportation, the cost, you know, rent actually accounting for more, a higher percentage of household income than it did 60 years ago, and maybe household, you know, food and other expenses going down as a percentage of household expenses. The cost of different utilities. We know that whether it's water or broadband or communications, these are costs that have gone up over the past decades as a percentage of household, you know, as a percentage of the household budget. All of these things have changed. The cost of childcare, health care, as I already mentioned, and then the debt burdens that households are carrying as well. All of these things are you know, profoundly different than they were 50, 60 years ago and need to be reflected in how we understand what, you know, how we're living today and therefore what the responsibility of the government is towards households that are struggling to make ends meet.
If we are, in fact, undercounting poverty in effect, what does that mean on a policy level? What changes because we don't have that more accurate grasp on how many people are struggling financially?
Well, it really limits the poverty line ends up being the baseline against which many federal programs are given appropriations. And so that it determines how much money goes into food stamps, you know, into the budget for food stamps and SNAP, or for WIC, the food assistance program for women, infants, and children, or for housing allocations, and so many other programs that millions and millions of people have rely on to meet all kinds of needs. And so when we don't have an accurate measure of poverty, then those allocations are, you know, those programs are not funded or organized to the extent that they need to be to meet our needs. And you can imagine, you know, by the calculation the Poor People's Campaign has done, so according to the federal poverty line, the official poverty measure, there are about 40 million people who live below the poverty line. We look at everyone who's looking below the poverty line, but also people who are living just above it. So that would mean, you know, for a family of four living on an income of less than $50,000 a year, or right around that. And if you look at that, then we're talking about 140 million people in this country who are poor or low income, and really no federal programs are designed to meet that kind of need. And therefore, millions, tens of millions of families are struggling, unnecessarily so, because there is an abundance in this country that could be moved to secure housing, secure water and utilities and food and health care and all the things we need if we were willing to face this pandemic of poverty.
Shali Gupta Barnes is with us from the Poor People's Campaign and the Cairo Center, looking at poverty, how we measure it in the United States. Her organization says we need a broader definition of poverty to understand the real problems in the country, and that could lead to different policy plans. Shelley, what kind of policies do you see, not just when it comes to measuring poverty and maybe that shorter term relief, but policies that could help people out of poverty in the first place?
I think it's a great question. I think when we think about poverty, we have to think about it really in terms of not just an income threshold, like whether or not you earn above or below this amount of income, but whether or not our needs are met. And that in and of itself is a profound shift in our orientation in this country. And so we have to make sure that our housing is secure. And we know that because of economic fallout from this, from the coronavirus pandemic, tens of millions of people are at risk of losing their housing in just a matter of weeks. And so this is something that is critical. We have to have our health care needs met. We have to be able to have clean water running through our faucets, and be able to put healthy, nutritious food on our table and make sure our children have the kind of education that they need, that we all need to thrive in this economy, and many other things. You know, we need to be able to provide for childcare and ensure that parents can work knowing that our children are taken care of, and for elder care and for retirement and pensions. And so really taking up the question of poverty from what it takes to live, as opposed to and meeting all of our human, you know, our basic human needs, is the orientation we push for in the Poor People's Campaign.
A reaction to suggestions like these sometimes is, okay, maybe some safety nets are okay for people in the most dire need, in the most difficult situations. If we start building up safety net programs, they start to be an alternative to what people say is the more valuable path, work, finding jobs, finding better jobs for people. Do you see the one interfering with the other?
We don't, really, not at all. There has been, you know, multiple research that has, you know, from the National Employment Law Project and other institutes that have shown that, you know, this is an argument that is commonly made also against this unemployment assistance that people have been receiving for the past weeks. And there are arguments being made right now that extending unemployment is going to keep people away from work. Well, if work is paid well, and we can manage our health care and not put our health at risk and our family's health at risk, and people, the research shows that people want to work. This is a core foundation of this society and all human society. And so, we don't see them as inconsistent. The platform that we've put out recently, the Jubilee platform, looks at securing work for everybody and securing the kind of safety net that can provide for those of us who can't or who can't work, and, you know, and to make sure that everybody is taken care of, regardless of whether or not we have the income to be able to afford, you know, these basic needs.
Shally, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
Shally Gupta-Barnes is Policy Director for the Kairos Center and the Poor People's Campaign. She joined us to talk about how the federal poverty line is calculated and why her organization is calling on the criteria to be changed. Coming up, we'll talk to a Wisconsin-based poverty expert to find out what's going on here in the state. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions about poverty in Wisconsin? Are there things you'd like to see state, local, or federal officials do to address poverty? What do you think is the best solution to poverty? Are you one of the people maybe living under the poverty line, or maybe just above it, but you feel that sense of a precarious existence? One big, say, health expense or car repair or something like that could throw the balance out of whack for you. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we continue our conversation about poverty and calls to change the criteria that the federal government uses to determine the poverty level. Our last guest recently wrote an opinion piece about the issue. You can read that. We've got a link at WPR.org. Now, we want to look at poverty closer to home. In Wisconsin, the poverty level seems to hover just above 10%, with a peak following the Great Recession and a more recent spike during the COVID-19 pandemic. The majority of those living in poverty are children, and while poverty remains especially high in some counties, like Milwaukee County, it is a statewide problem. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you see a lot of poverty, however you define it, in your own community, your part of the state? Do you have questions about poverty in Wisconsin and efforts to relieve it and turn it around? How does it affect you and your family now or in the past? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Sarah Halpern-Meekin joins us now, Associate Professor of Human Development and Family Studies at UW-Madison. Sarah, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Well, we just heard Shelley Gupta-Barnes from the Poor People's Campaign. They say, in effect, the federal measure of poverty, this long-running measure of poverty, underrepresents poverty levels in the United States. What do you think about that?
So as Shelley described, the supplemental poverty measure takes a much more comprehensive look at the set of costs and benefits that families and households face. And so it provides us with a more comprehensive, more accurate picture of who is actually experiencing poverty. That means that for some groups, we're undercounting poverty. For other groups who might benefit more from available government support, we might be overcounting poverty. Similarly, in some areas with low costs of living, we might be overcounting poverty. And in other areas with high costs of living, we might be drastically undercounting poverty. So basically, it gives us an inaccurate picture of who and where poverty is highest.
Does that drive problems with policies and policy outcomes?
Well, what it means is that most essentially, we don't get to see, when we use the official poverty measure, the effects of our policies in combating poverty. And I think this is, for me, the biggest problem with it, because we can look at our poverty measures, which don't take into account the effect of any benefit programs, like through taxes, like the earned income tax credit. And so then we look and we say, we're spending all this money on policies and our poverty rates aren't budging. But that's because of how we calculate our poverty rates, not because those programs have no effect on poverty. So we know, for example, that the earned income tax credit lifts millions of kids out of poverty, but our official poverty measure is designed in such a way that we can never capture that in our statistics.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Lori is with us in Vernon County. Lori, hello.
Oh, hello. Yes, thank you. Yes, I called about a solution to poverty. Long ago, conservatives and honest liberals used to agree that cash assistance was the most effective way to alleviate poverty because, after all, people know best how to spend money. That's what the market tells us, so conservatives like it. And when we eliminated that AFDC, as we know it, and the way it was done, we lost track, it seems, of a whole lot of people who kind of fell off the rolls at that point, right? And that's what we're seeing in Milwaukee, because Milwaukee's where it started first with the voucher systems and the experiment welfare, or the work fair and the bride fair and all the rest of it. So we lost all these people where they fell away from, you know, they made it harder to get assistance in so many ways. So those are two things I'd like the guest to speak on. And then also in this time, we're seeing that there's a whole lot of work that goes on out here that women basically don't get paid for. So maybe a universal basic income, you know, back to the cash assistance would be a way to acknowledge that we can care for each other, you know. And
Lori,
anyway,
thanks a lot for calling, and you gave us a lot to work with there. So Lori's saying, hey, how about more straightforward cash assistance programs as opposed to, say, a housing program for this and a child care program for that and so on?
So we certainly did see in 1996 welfare reform that was modeled substantially based on what had happened in Wisconsin. And so we saw the end of Aid to Families with Dependent Children, AFDC, which was replaced by Temporary Assistance for Needy Families, or TANF. And what that meant, you know, it had already started happening here in Wisconsin, but what it meant across the country is that many people came off the welfare rolls, in part buoyed by a really strong national economy by that time. So there were a lot of jobs available for people to move into. We have not seen TANF be able to respond when we've had drastic increases in need, such as we did during the Great Recession and such as we're having right now. So it means that TANF is actually received by a very small minority of poor families across the United States. So it really no longer serves as a safety net for most people. There have been, as the caller discussed, recent growing calls to look at things like a universal basic income. That is a really different sort of approach to supporting families, first because it's universal. So while TANF was targeted at lower income people, a universal basic income seeks to give money to all people regardless of their income. There are also ways that there have been discussions around targeting cash assistance, for example, giving child allowances and making those child allowances larger for lower income families and for families with really young children, where those early investments can pay off in the biggest dividends and development and growth later on.
Lori, thanks for calling in. We're talking to Sarah Halpern-Meekin from UW-Madison about poverty in Wisconsin and programs meant to tackle it. Back to your calls now. Catherine is with us in Milwaukee. Catherine, hi.
Hi. I just wanted to share my experience. I've lived around the poverty line for a couple years in Michigan and in Wisconsin, and I don't think people realize really the toll that it takes when you essentially are at the poverty line, when you're, you know, maybe $1,000 annually above the cutoff, and how little of a difference that actually makes in your day-to-day life, and how when I was in that situation, just like it almost felt like my breath is being taken away from me when I'm counting every penny, or when I was denied Badger Care because I made about $80 a month too much and was then expected to pay a $200 premium a month for health insurance. And just wanted to share that experience with people because I think there's a lot of like moralizing and patronizing that goes into this, and people don't know what it's really like.
Catherine, thanks for sharing your experience. I appreciate that. Sarah, your thoughts.
What Catherine was saying was so important. So first, there is so much judgment that goes on connecting people's moral worth to their income, and that really neglects understanding the context that leads people to have the incomes that they do. And as the first caller said, it often neglects to value the unpaid work that so many people do in their households and in their communities. The other thing that I wanted to pick up on what Catherine was talking about, was the importance to some administrative details of how programs are set up. So when programs are set up to have what we call a benefit cliff, where if you earn below a certain amount, you get the benefit, and if you earn above a certain amount, you don't get the benefit, it puts families in a really difficult position. Like Catherine was saying, she earned $80 too much to get a benefit. And so if we pay attention to how we set programs up administratively so there can be sort of extended phase in and phase out ranges so that families don't hit that benefit cliff. It can help make families feel more secure that as their income rises, they're not all of a sudden going to lose a benefit.
Catherine, thanks again for calling in. Sarah, what are you watching for now? And I assume we're still probably gathering data on this, but when it comes to the impact of COVID-19 and the economic damage it caused on poverty here in Wisconsin.
So we can see that things are, you know, difficult across the state and across the nation. That's very clear. One thing that I'm paying attention to are the ways that the pandemic is really shining a light on some of the disadvantages that already existed before. So, you know, the first caller talked about the value of care work and how there's a new discussion about that. We've heard discussion during the pandemic of paying attention to racial and ethnic health disparities and those sorts of things. All of these things existed before the pandemic, and the pandemic is really shining a light on them. And so I think we're paying attention to some disadvantages that often got swept under the rug before. Go ahead.
I was going to say very briefly, Sarah, if we're paying attention to those, do you see movement to change things to fix some of those pre-existing problems?
I think the conversation is starting to recognize them, and recognizing a problem is a first step to being able to solve it, because if you don't recognize it, you can't solve it. But I think it really remains to be seen what policy movement will be, both at the local, state, and federal levels around those areas.
Sarah, thanks a lot for joining us today. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Sarah Halpern-Meakin is an associate professor of human development and family studies at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. We talked about poverty here in Wisconsin, the impact it has, and policies that could help deal with it. Earlier, we talked to a guest about how poverty is measured around the country, what it does and doesn't take into account. Coming up after the news, we'll hear about a Wisconsin research lab that's playing a big role with a big new grant from the CDC to try to answer some of our complicated questions about the novel coronavirus. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Listening to Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we continue our candidate interviews in the 3rd District's August primary for Congress. First, even though the coronavirus has been big news for months now, it's still pretty new in the scope of things, and there's a lot we don't know. A Wisconsin research institute is playing a central role in the Center for Disease Control's push to learn more about the virus and how it operates. Jennifer Meese is the director of the Integrated Research and Development Laboratory at the Marshfield Clinic Research Institute. The CDC awarded Marshfield Clinic a $22.5 million grant to study how the new coronavirus is transmitted and can be treated. Jennifer, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Well, a big picture, what is this grant going to work toward at Marshfield?
Yeah, so Marshfield Clinic Research Institute, we were awarded a very large central testing laboratory grant from the CDC. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention has established a number of studies across the U.S. and in Puerto Rico to better understand the transmission, risk factors, epidemiology, outcomes, all sorts of questions around SARS-CoV-2 infection. And my laboratory was, we submitted and applied for the central testing laboratory component of that those various studies, and we were awarded it. So all of the specimens from these well-designed studies will be coming to one central laboratory for testing so that methods are standardized and reporting is standardized, and so things will be very comparable across the various studies that the CDC is funding.
With this being such a new disease, it seems like a lot of the research that's coming out is kind of opportunistic. It was based on who happened to be at a hospital at a particular time, which is great that they're doing it, but that's the best we can do. Can you talk about the kind of studies that we can do, you know, when we're planning things out better and not just having to take, you know, whoever happens to walk in the door?
Right. So that's exactly why these studies are so important, because It allows us to prospectively enroll people into studies. We can monitor them over time during periods of illness as well as when they're not ill. We can study risk factors in households. For example, one of the studies is a household transmission study. So we'll enroll the household into the study, and every week they'll submit specimens. We'll be able to look at things like asymptomatic carriers or when people get infected in relationship to index cases in households. So it allows us to very prospectively design studies, ask questions about behaviors and lifestyle and underlying medical conditions and all of the factors that play into risks and outcomes associated with this disease. And then with the samples coming to a standard laboratory for, you know, testing in the same method, there's not the intervariability between lab tests and methods and procedures. So it allows us to answer questions in a much more structured approach. We can think through the questions that we want to ask in advance and make sure we implement the study procedures to ask and answer those questions.
You mentioned a couple of them already, but what are some of the other biggest open questions about the novel coronavirus that you're hoping this research can start to answer?
Well, I think, you know, some of the big ones are you know, let's think about, we hear a lot about asymptomatic carriers. So, you know, who are the people walking around that are shedding the virus but aren't sick? That's a really big question. Why do some people get sick and other people don't get sick? One of the studies, there's a sub-study of one of the studies, and we're not doing this testing, but there's a genetics component to it. Why do some people get sick and don't, others do not? It really allows us to look at the entire spectrum of the disease. We can look at questions like reinfection. That's a really big one right now. Some of the studies also have, in addition to the testing that we're doing, they would have blood samples that would be taken at or around an illness event and then downstream from the illness event. So we can look at the duration of antibody response after an infection. We're not set up to do this right now, but obviously some of the longer-term questions will be around vaccine effectiveness, if a vaccine becomes available, and the duration of immunity from a vaccine, which again isn't part of this study, but it's certainly a question that's going to be asked in of really key importance for public health response in the future.
We're talking to Jennifer Meese, director of the Integrated Research and Development Laboratory at the Marshfield Clinic Research Institute. The CDC has awarded Marshfield Clinic a $22.5 million grant to help do standardized studies of a lot of different open questions when it comes to the virus that causes COVID-19. I understand a big part of this is going to include influenza and COVID-19. Now, COVID-19 was hitting us as the flu season was tapering off. Another flu season is going to come around before we know it. Can you talk about the questions there if we have both of these illnesses circulating at the same time?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it's going to be really important to distinguish the clinical features of these two diseases. Do they look different or do they look the same? We don't understand the ability to have co-infections. We don't understand if people will be more or less likely to have influenza. Will social distancing have an impact on influenza transmission? We'll be able to test for both of these pathogens, and in both the surveillance swabs that are collected weekly as well as in the illness swab. So we'll be able to maybe make associations between different symptoms of COVID-19 versus influenza infection. It's going to be a complex fall and winter, I think, in terms of understanding these two, how they co-circulate in the environment, and how we're going to mitigate that from a public health perspective. In a hostile environment, you maybe need to segregate your populations differently based on what infection they have. There's just, you know, we've really never lived through a time when both of these kinds of respiratory infectious diseases are in our population. So it's really a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to understand how that's going to go.
A big question, and one we're going to talk about later on the show, is how we handle back-to-school time. And I understand that one thing we do know with influenza is that often it's spread in schools. Kids can get it, take it home, keep transmitting it around. That's one of the biggest questions, as I understand it, for novel coronavirus Are kids less likely to spread that than influenza? Is any of the research going to be tackling that?
Well, I think we'll be able to look at some of those questions. Obviously, in a family environment with some of the cohort studies that are family transmission studies, those will be some of the questions that will be asked. You know, behavioral questions. Do kids go to school? You know, how many hours a day do you do this activity? Do you participate in sports? So, the great thing about these kinds of studies is it allows us to really think through the kinds of questions and gather the data up front. And then at the backside, you can analyze the data in, 100 different ways to look at associations between different behaviors and outcomes and all sorts of things that are going to be able to be asked. There's so many questions that are hopefully going to be better illuminated so we can make a playbook for the future and better know how to deal with pandemics if we ever encounter one again.
A lot of the questions that individual people have are, what activities are more safe or more hazardous? If someone in the household gets COVID-19, how do we, be as safe as we can to make sure the rest of the family doesn't get it? Are you hoping that your research now and the testing you're going to be doing is going to start to provide some of those actionable answers that people can take in their daily lives?
Absolutely. That's where capturing behavioral information and health information and activity information and lifestyle information while we're prospectively following these people over time is going to help us better look for those kinds of risk factors and also asking questions about when it is in your household, how do people behave in response to that? So all of those things are part of these study designs. So with big populations that we're studying, hopefully these kinds of questions and answers will be more generalizable across the United States. The other thing about this study, these studies, and there are, six of them hosted across, multiple states representing a variety of geographic areas, different temperatures and climates and, city sizes and socioeconomic status and race and ethnicity. So we're able to look at, big populations and hopefully make some assumptions that can be generalizable across our country.
Now, I know some of the work you mentioned can't even start yet because some of it might involve a hypothetical vaccine and how it works. But that said, do you have a timeline in mind where we might start to see at least early results from some of the work that's going to come through your lab?
Yeah, I mean, we'll be reporting out data on it several times a day. And I would, there'll be interim analyses of some of the findings. We recognize that while these are well-structured and standardized studies, we may have to make adjustments as we go. You know, one of the things that we've all been struggling with in testing, whether it's in research or in the clinical realm, is the availability of testing materials, collection materials. So we need to remain agile and flexible in what we ask and how we answer those questions, because supply chain is really not going to go away as a problem, especially as we enter into a, potentially a more severe respiratory season.
Jennifer, we'll leave it there. Thanks for sharing the research with us.
Well, thank you for giving me the opportunity to share it.
That's Jennifer Meese, director of the Integrated Research and Development Laboratory at the Marshfield Clinic Research Institute. The CDC awarded Marshfield Clinic a $22.5 million grant to study how the novel coronavirus is transmitted and can be treated. Coming up, we meet one of the two candidates running as a Republican to represent Wisconsin's 3rd Congressional District as our series of primary candidate interviews continues. That's coming up next here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Do you have plans to travel this summer here in the state? What about outside Wisconsin? How about outside the U.S.? Coming up, we'll take a look at whether it's still safe to fly, rent a car, stay at a hotel, and how the travel industry is adapting to the coronavirus. First, between now and next month's primary election, Wisconsin Public Radio has invited candidates who are running in contested races for congressional seats to join us for interviews on Central Time and The Morning Show. You'll be able to find all of these interviews at WPR.org/politics. Earlier this week, we talked to the seat's incumbent, Representative Ron Kind, a Democrat, and his opponent in the Democratic primary in Wisconsin's 3rd District, Mark Newman. Also running, Republican Jesse Eben. We'll talk to her tomorrow. And on the other side of the Republican primary, today we talked to Derek Van Orden. He served in the Navy for 26 years, including 21 as a SEAL and combat medic. Now retired, he's a hobby farmer in Hager City. Derek Van Orden, welcome to Central Time.
Well, Rob, thank you for having me. I actually love your show. Thank you.
Oh, thank you so much. Well, start us off with your basic pitch. Why are you the right person to represent the 3rd District in Congress?
Well, I mean, you kind of skipped the bio. That's great, a little in there. But my brother and I were raised in abject rural poverty in southwestern Minnesota and then also in Waukesha County in Heartland. My wife's family is from Ashland County, where I'm at right now. Actually, I drove up because, fortunately, I'm going to attend a funeral for one of our deputy sheriffs. His name is Dylan Wagner. He was killed off duty. And I just, for a minute before we get kicking here, I'd like everybody, if they have a minute, to pray for Bree. That is his significant other and his one-year-old son, Easton. So if anybody's listening, I'd appreciate it if you prayed for them. So, yeah, we lived in southwestern Minnesota and then grew up really in Heartland, Wisconsin, which I consider my home. And then I joined the Navy when I was 18 years old and worked on a tugboat for a couple of years and then decided to become a medic. And that's where I learned about the SEAL teams. I deployed 8 times and 5 of those to combat. I've worked on 5 of the 7 continents as a SEAL and as a medic. After I retired, my wife and I opened a small business and we ran that for a couple of years, got it going and then sold it. I was very thankful for doing that. And I did corporate leadership with some folks. And I decided to get into politics when I wrote Ron Kind an email and asked him about the impeachment of the President of the United States, and he just didn't write me back. So I called his office, and they didn't call me back, and I started looking into this guy, Ron Kind. He's been in office for 24 years, and realized that Ron is the reason that Congress has a lower approval rating than the IRS. And I talked to my wife about this, and we prayed about it. I am a Christian, and we pray frequently. That's what we do. And decided to run against them. So we formed a very high-performance team. You understand that we are in a primary now. Just want to be open. We won the 3rd District Caucus with a supermajority over 70% on the first ballot during that primary. So that was wonderful. That's a very big show of support from the district itself. And throughout this process, I've realized a lot of the issues that we're having in the nation are because we have now and have had people for quite a while now in leadership positions who are just not leaders. And if you look at what's taking place in Minneapolis, we've got a young mayor there who's never been in leadership. We look at Governor Evers, and I know some people like him, others don't, but he was an educator, and I love learning myself. You know, I've got a bachelor's of science, and education is absolutely important in this nation, but he had really no leadership experience, and we're having some issues in the state of Wisconsin. You look what's happening in Seattle and all over the place. And what I'm bringing to the table here is tested, proven leadership. Decades of that in the military as a Navy SEAL, you mentioned that, in business as a small business owner, a hobby farmer, a father, a grandfather. It's what we need right now in our country is tested, proven leadership, experience-based knowledge on how things really work. And we have to unite as a country, which I've built high-performance teams my entire adult life, and that's what I'm going to do when I get to Washington, D.C.
What do you see as the biggest issue facing the 3rd District in that region of Wisconsin right now?
Well, we are an agricultural district. We have one major manufacturer, and the rest is really ag. And the problems with agriculture are we have it's a commodities-based industry. And I know Ron Kind is real fond of saying that, you know, he goes to sleep and thinking about farmers. He wakes up in the morning thinking about farmers. And unfortunately, if you guys track the news, which I know you do, you realize that they've made an addendum to the CARES bill with the Paycheck Protection Program. You're familiar with this. It was interesting that I thought that when they passed the largest spending bill since World War II and with the PPP, Ron Kind, he's Nancy Pelosi's chief whip on the Ways and Means Committee, so he starts writing this stuff, right? The one group of people that was forgotten were dairy farmers. Dairy farmers were not in the original PPP. Ron Kind was responsible for writing that legislation, and he forgot them, but he's going to come back here to the district and tell everybody he thinks about farmers all day long. That's just, it doesn't comport with reality. That is an untruthful statement. So what we need to do in our 3rd District is we need to make sure that we're leveling this playing field for our agricultural industry. And the passage of the USMCA has been significant. We've had a rise in dairy prices since July 1st, which is huge because that's when it was first implemented. Ron, as I mentioned, is Nancy Pelosi's chief whip on the Ways and Means Committee. That bill was held up for over a year in the Ways and Means Committee. We lost over 1,000 farms in the state of Wisconsin because USMCA was held up because, unfortunately, Ron and Nancy and the rest of the gang there did not want to give Donald Trump a political victory. They were focused on this impeachment stuff. So what we have to do is focus on making sure that we continue down this road. It's a phased implementation of the USMCA so that our farmers in the third district have a level playing field to compete on, because our farmers are the hardest working folks in the country. We are literally the heartland of the heartland, and we can beat anybody in the world when we have the ability to do so with a level playing field. That's what USMCA has done. I'm very, very proud of that. I got to
talk to Derek Van Orden, candidate in the Republican primary for Wisconsin's 3rd Congressional District. That is in central and western Wisconsin. Just have a few minutes left, and I want to hit a couple more issues before we run out of time. Your thoughts on what the government should be doing, the federal government and Congress should be doing when it comes to tackling coronavirus?
Well, what our federal government should be doing about tackling coronavirus, I think that we need to look at it objectively and call it what it is. We have a very dangerous virus that's out there. I have a friend who's a retired Navy SEAL who was on a ventilator for, 45 days. So it's real. I'm not discounting that in any way, shape, or form. And the loss of one human being is a tragedy to at least one other human being. So I don't want anyone to think for a moment that I'm blowing this off. But however, we've gotten to the point where we are killing the patient in order to cure a disease. We have to find a way, and I think the Trump administration is actually doing a very good job, they get no credit, of striking the balance between opening up the country, because now we have the highest rate of unemployment since the Great Depression. We went from the largest, the best economy since World War II, I think probably 1946 our economy was stronger, to Depression-level unemployment. And the reason being is because 45 governors independently decided to shut down their states, and that destroyed this incredibly powerful economy within 90 days. So the federal government should be providing assistance to the state and local governments as they ask for it. Being in the military for a very long time, there's something called a 2,000-mile-long screwdriver. And when a headquarters tries to fix something for you by telling you what you need to do, it never works out. It's horrible, and it's actually onerous. You look at Joe Biden and all these plans these people are cooking up on the left, they're trying to force solutions on governors, and it just doesn't work. It has never worked in the history of man. It certainly doesn't work in the military, and it doesn't work in the government. So the federal government should be standing by, and they are. President Trump and Vice President Pence are on the task force. They're standing by, and when state governments, even Governor Cuomo, complimented the Trump administration for providing the stuff that they need. And that's what the federal government should be doing. They should be standing by with resources, if that's money, if that's PPE, whatever it is. And when the governors ask for it, they should provide it to them. So I think they're doing a great job, and they need to continue to do so.
Just briefly, less than a minute left, do you see opportunities for bipartisan cooperation if you're in Congress next year?
Well, of course. I mean, absolutely. We have to be able to form alliances to make sure that we achieve goals. The cheese does not stand alone, man. We have to be able to, and I've done this my entire adult life, being able to build alliances with like-minded people in order to get done what needs to get done. I'm going to tell you, so one more thing. Ron Klein is a consummate politician, but he's not a statesman. What we need are statesmen, which are putting the needs of our district and the needs of our nation above our own personal partisan beliefs. And he says he's the fifth most bipartisan member of Congress. Okay, great. But he votes with Nancy Pelosi, Adam Schiff, Jerry Nadler, and the squad 95% of the time. Those are all facts. It's public record. I will reach across the aisle when we need to. I'm going to form alliances with like-minded Republicans and then Democrats and independents to make sure that we get stuff done for America. This is the best country in the world. And I want people to hold their heads up high and realize that we have been gifted by God, just being born here or moved here and become citizens as legal immigrants. It's fantastic. And I'm going to do everything I can to make sure that we continue to have this wonderful country for our kids and our grandkids.
And we'll leave it there. Thanks to Derek Van Orden, running as a Republican in the August primary for Wisconsin's 3rd Congressional District in western, southwestern, and central parts of the state. Earlier this week, we heard from Daniel Higgins with the USA Today Network in Green Bay. He made the case for not boiling brats before grilling them. Now I see he has another controversial food statement out there. Zucchini, he says, he writes, is overrated. It's okay, he says, disguised heavily as bread, maybe with some chocolate chips, or hidden in other recipes. Quoting him now, on its own, blech. He wants people to prove him wrong, and we might bring him back onto the show to talk about that. Well, we want to hear from you in the meantime. Are you having zucchini popping up all around you? Do you have tons of it? Are you doing the old Wisconsin reverse theft where you drop zucchini on people's front steps and then run away? Let us know your current zucchini situation and your favorite way to use it. And do you want to make a case for zucchini as a great standalone item? Let us know, email ideas@WPR.org or tweet us at Central Time WPR. Or are you in the anti-zucchini faction? Again, email ideas@WPR.org or tweet us at Central Time WPR. And maybe we'll talk to Daniel in the future to make his case against zucchini. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.